It's good to be here with you. I'm Bob Stewart, and this is my first time ever to speak here at the National Conference on Christian Apologetics. And I can't tell you what a thrill it is for me. I hope that you're still thrilled with the conference after I speak. But we do have a commercial. Let's put the slide up here, Marilyn, for the conference. They told me I could promote a different conference. It's not at the same time. This is the Defend the Faith Conference, or Defend 19. And I teach at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. I direct this conference. We will have about 50 speakers over 5 days. And many of our speakers that are speaking here will also be speaking there. And it's a great deal, especially if you're in college. The cost for the full week conference is $120, but if you're a college student, we waive that registration fee entirely because we have a burden and a passion to train collegians in how to defend their faith. Also, if you're in high school, we'll waive it entirely. And we have some great packages for students, and we have a great screen that moves. And also, we have some fabulous deals for group leaders. And if you're a leader and you bring three students or three church members or three human beings, I'd love to talk to you more about it. But this is that's all the commercial that you're going to get. Except I would say this also: it's about 130 hours of apologetics teaching. We record it all. And everybody who comes and registers for the full week, we give them every minute of it, free of charge. So that's a great great deal for you too. So this is what's wrong with the new atheism. So what I'd like to do in this talk is, number one, introduce you to the new atheism and tell you some of their core values and some of their characteristic practices. And one of those characteristic practices is that they call themselves naturalists. So then I would like to give you some reasons that I'm not a naturalist. And I think they're pretty devastating reasons for naturalism. And then give you some, if we have time, give you some strategies for how to share your faith with atheists and with naturalists. So let's introduce the new atheism. Let's look at this brochure. It's a poster from an Atheist Alliance International convention. And what we really want to see is the top row, where we've got Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens. And these are the so-called four horsemen of the new atheism. And we get that label from an article that Gary North wrote in Wired magazine about 11 or 12 years ago. And so the new atheism is not something that you join. And so it's not simply Dawkins, Dennett, Harris, and Hitchens, but it is, those guys are the superstars, they're the rock stars of the new atheism. So let me unpack it a bit for you and give you some of their core beliefs. And core belief number one of the new atheist is that science and religion are mutually exclusive ways of looking at life. In short, you have to choose between religion or science. Religion and science are at war. And I'll give you a quotation from Daniel Dennett. He says this: almost no one is indifferent to Darwin, and no one should be. The Darwinian theory is a scientific theory and a great one, but that is not all it is. The creationists who oppose it so bitterly are right about one thing. Darwin's dangerous idea cuts much deeper into the fabric of our most fundamental beliefs than many of its sophisticated apologists have yet admitted, even to themselves. And that's from his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Or the late Stephen Hawking put it this way in a newspaper article interview. He said, "The question is the way the universe began chosen by God for reasons we can't understand, or was it determined by a law of science? I believe the second. Okay, so those would be two examples. I could multiply each and every example many times over. Their second core belief, not only are science and religion at war, their second core belief is that faith is a superstitious, blind leap based on the denial of evidence. Here's an example from Richard Dawkins. He says this, faith is a great cop-out, the great excuse to think, to evade the need to think and to evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. And so we see that definition. Their third core belief is that religion is inherently evil, that religion makes people do bad things. And Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg put it this way in a New York Times article. He said, with or without religion, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion. That's a pretty snarky comment, isn't it? Now, the theistic physicist Freeman Dyson responded to Weinberg's statement by saying this. He said, and for bad people to do good things, that also takes religion. Well, Richard Dawkins puts it this way, revealed faith is not harmless nonsense. It can be lethally dangerous nonsense. Dangerous because it gives people unshakable confidence in their own righteousness. Dangerous because it gives them false courage to kill themselves, which automatically removes normal barriers to killing others. And dangerous because we have all bought into a weird respect, which uniquely protects religion from normal criticism. Let's stop being so damn respectful. Or you can always count on Sam Hitchens to cut to the chase. He says this, some propositions are so dangerous that it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them. Well, what are some of their characteristic practices? Well, characteristic practice number one. Now, a difference between a characteristic practice and a core belief is a characteristic practice is something you do regularly. It's something that people pick up on about you. And here is, I would say, characteristic practice number one. They have a superficial knowledge of the Bible. A superficial knowledge of the Bible. I'll give you an example of an occasion where I picked up on this. Now, every atheist that I've ever met, there might be an atheist out there that I haven't met that wouldn't be true of, but every atheist I've ever met and talked to has been quick to tell me, I've read the Bible. I know the Bible. Okay, so I direct a program at the seminary called the Greer Heard Forum. And in the Greer Heard Forum, we bring in the top intellectuals in the world from a Christian standpoint, conservative evangelical standpoint, and then we bring in others. They may be atheists, like Sean Carroll or Daniel Dennett, both of whom have spoken at the forum. They may be agnostics, like Bart Ehrman, or they may be liberals, like John Dominic Crossan or Paul Nitter. But we bring them together to dialogue with great Christian thinkers, and it's a two-day conference. So we had Daniel Dennett and Alistair McGrath dialoguing on the future of atheism. And I think Dennett was totally surprised by what Southern Baptists are. Southern Baptists don't believe in coercion. We do believe in persuasion. But we absolutely, one of our bedrock core principles is soul freedom, that people should have the right to decide for themselves to be religious, to not be religious, to believe, not to believe. Think for themselves. And so we champion that. And Dennett was pleasantly surprised. Now, I don't know what Dennett thought he was going to experience when he came to New Orleans Baptist Seminary, but I think it was something like he would drive onto the campus and be met by 200 rednecks with 300 guns. Something like that. But So after the conference, we were out at dinner in a very nice New Orleans restaurant, one of the restaurants that Emeril Lagasse owns. And he was just complimenting me on how great a host I'd been, which is true. I really am a nice guy. But I looked at him and I said, well, you know, Dan, I really am an evangelical Christian. And I really want everyone to give their life to Jesus Christ, even you. And he launched into this soliloquy about how he was a Darwinist first and an atheist second, that his Darwinism led him to atheism. But he said, I'm not interested in the quest for the historical Charles Darwin. I don't care about those debates over the particularities of his life. What I want is people to read his books, see his genius, and appreciate his thinking. He said, Jesus was a great man too. Why can't you Christians be like that with Jesus? And my answer was, well, Dan, because Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life. And no one comes to the Father but by me. And it was like I'd taken out a 2x4 and hit him between the eyes. He'd never heard that verse, apparently. Now, that's like one of the 10 best-known verses in the whole Bible, right? And, of course, Dan Dennett had told me, oh, I've read the Bible. They have a superficial knowledge of the Bible. What they do is they cherry-pick the Bible. They find the passages that look like they're problems to us, like Old Testament Holy War and those issues, and then they harp on those. And, of course, many Christians fall into the trap because we don't know the Bible any better than many atheists. Secondly, they are theological novices. Theological novices. They don't understand the intricacies and subtleties of Christian theology. I've got a quotation here from Oliver Berkman. Oliver Berkman is a British journalist. If he's a Christian, I don't know it. And he says this about the new atheist. He says, God, in short, isn't one very impressive thing among many things that might or might not exist. He's not just some especially resplendent object among all the objects illuminated by the light of being. Rather, God is the light of being itself, the answer to the question of why there's existence to begin with. In other words, that wisecrack about how atheists merely believe in one less God than theists do, though it makes a funny line in a Tim Minchin song, is just a category error. Monotheism's God isn't like one of the Greek gods, except that he happens to have no friends. It's an utterly different kind of concept. And then third, they are primarily irreligious, especially anti-Christian and anti-Muslim. Primarily irreligious. And let me read to you a quotation from a secular humanist, Greg Epstein. Now, Greg Epstein is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. And that's not an oxymoron. Humanist chaplain, Harvard University. And he writes this, I believe in the Washington Post. He says, while atheism is the lack of belief in any God, anti-theism means actively seeking out the worst aspects of faith in God and portraying them as representative of all religion. Anti-theism seeks to shame and embarrass people away from religion, browbeating them about the stupidity of belief in a bellicose or warlike God. And they are naturalists. And when we talk about naturalism, what we're not talking about people that love nature. Okay? We're not talking about a scientist or a historian who would practice methodological naturalism. We're talking about metaphysical naturalists. They are materialist, that the things that we can know, the things that we can be certain about, can be measured by the scientific method. So I want to unpack these core beliefs and see how well they fare. So number one is science and religion, are they contradictory? Can you be a scientist and be a Christian? Well, apparently you can. Look at this list of believing scientists. I don't know how well you can see it, but I'll read through some of the names on the list. It's like the Hall of Fame of the history of Western science. And this is just a brief sliver of it. Copernicus, Christian. Galileo, Christian. Kepler, Newton, Lister, Pasteur, Boyle, Rayleigh, Fleming, Maxwell, Faraday, Kelvin, Mendel. Apparently you can be a Christian and a scientist. It's not one or the other. Or let me read to you from an agnostic, the late Stephen Jay Gould, who taught paleontology at Harvard University. He put it this way. He said, "To say it for all my colleagues, and for the umpteenth millionth time, science simply cannot, by its legitimate methods, adjudicate the issue of God's possible superintendence of nature. We neither affirm nor deny it. We simply can't comment on it as scientists. Either half my colleagues are enormously stupid, or else the science of Darwinism is fully compatible with conventional religious beliefs, and equally compatible with atheism, thus proving that the two great realms of nature's factuality and the source of human morality do not strongly overlap." And that actually comes from a book review or a review article of Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial. And it's a scathing review of intelligent design. But he makes this offhand comment along the way. Now, many atheists and naturalists of the new atheist bent would say, well, yeah, you used to be able to be a Christian and a scientist, because we didn't know then what we know now. Sure, Galileo could be a Christian. Sure, Isaac Newton could believe in God. Sure. But not today. Well, let's look at Francis Collins. Now, Francis Collins is, by anybody's estimation, one of the top five living scientists today. He was the director of the Human Genome Project. Today, he's the director of the National Institutes of Health. He's the man that led the team that isolated the gene that caused cystic fibrosis, as well as about 10 other diseases. Work that he has pioneered is today being used to cure cancer. There are some kinds of cancer that are now being cured, not just treated, not just being put in remission, because of this man's work. He is, by anyone's estimation, one of the top five living scientists today. And he says this, "For quite a while in my 20s, I was a pretty obnoxious atheist. At the age of 27, after a good deal of intellectual debating with myself about the plausibility of faith, and particularly with strong influence from C.S. Lewis, I became convinced that this was a decision I wanted to make. And I became by choice a Christian, a serious Christian, who believes that faith is not something that you just do on Sunday. But if it makes any sense at all, it is part of your whole life. It's the most important organizing principle in my life." Or John Lennox puts it this way, "When it comes to thinking about God..." I wish I had an Irish accent right now. "When it comes to thinking about God, why do some otherwise rational, intelligent people seem unaware that they become irrational? They insist on offering the public a choice between God and science, when elementary logic should tell them that theology and science are not alternatives, but complementary. God is an explanation in terms of agency, and science in terms of mechanism and law. I find it easy to explain this distinction to most teenagers. Well, let's take up this question. Is faith belief in spite of no evidence or a lack of evidence? Well, C.S. Lewis didn't think so. In Mere Christianity, he says this: I'm not asking anyone to accept Christianity if his best reasoning tells him that the weight of evidence is against it. That is not the point at which faith comes in. Or Lennox says this: faith is not a leap in the dark. It's the exact opposite. It's a commitment based on evidence. It is irrational to reduce all faith to blind faith and then subject it to ridicule. That provides a very anti-intellectual and convenient way of avoiding intelligent discussion. In fact, I know of no orthodox theologian who would define faith as a way to evade evidence. What about the question of religion poisoning everything? Well, apparently Saint Nietzsche didn't share this opinion. I hope you know Friedrich Nietzsche was not a Christian. He says this in The Will to Power. He says another Christian concept, no less crazy, he's not complimenting us, has passed even more deeply into the tissue of modernity. The concept of the equality of souls before God. This concept furnishes the prototype of all theories of equal rights. Mankind was first taught to stammer the proposition of equality in a religious context, and only later was it made into morality. Well, Nietzsche thinks equality is a bad thing. He doesn't believe in equality, but most sane people, and Nietzsche died in an insane asylum, think it's a good thing. Or the Catholic philosopher Thomas Crean puts it this way in his book, which is a response to Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. He says, still one point is worth making, an answer to the author's claim that religion causes people to do evil things. Insofar as this is true, it has no tendency to show that religion itself is a bad thing or that its message is false. Love causes people to do evil things. So does patriotism. The love of a man and a woman can lead to unfaithfulness, to the destruction of families, and even to murder. Patriotism can lead to hatred and to the indiscriminate bombing of cities. None of this means that either love or patriotism is a bad thing. It simply means that the weakness of human nature is such that any great object or cause may stir our emotions as to lead us to act against our better judgment. If religion occasions evil as well as good, this is no sign of its falsity, but simply of its power of attraction over human nature. That in the name of religion, good men may do bad things is no argument against religion, unless crimes of passion are arguments against human love. I wish I could have said it that well. So, that's a bit of that. What I want to do in this section is give you some reasons that I am not a naturalist, or some reasons that friends don't let friends become naturalist, okay? Number one, I'm not a naturalist because naturalism is self-refuting. Naturalism is self-refuting. Let me run over again what naturalism is, what I mean. I mean someone who says that my worldview is determined by science. If it can't be measured by science, it can't be real. It doesn't exist. It cannot be known. Now, this is a quotation from the Center for Naturalism. Now, I have heard that not everything on the internet is true. I have heard that people put things on the internet sometimes without thinking. And so let me introduce you to the Center for Naturalism. Now, the Center for Naturalism is an atheistic think tank. And it's run by some very intelligent people. Dan Dennett is on the board of advisors for the Center for Naturalism. Okay, Dennett's a highly educated guy. Degree from Harvard University, where he worked with Willard Van Orman Quine. Philosophy degree from Oxford, where he worked with Gilbert Ryle. One of the top philosophers living today. Very smart guy. Susan Blackmore and a host of other Ivy League professors are on the board of the Center for Naturalism. So naturalism.org is not some angry atheist posting on the internet at 3 in the morning in his basement in his underwear eating Oreos and drinking Coors Light. Okay, nothing like that. It's a respectable sort of source. And they say this in their tenets of naturalism. Naturalism, as a worldview, is based on the premise that knowledge about what exists and about how things work is best achieved through the sciences, not personal revelation or religious tradition. Scientific empiricism has the necessary consequence of unifying our knowledge of the world, of placing all objects of understanding within an overarching causal context. Under naturalism, there is a single natural world in which phenomena arise. Now, the problem is that there's no way to prove this position scientifically, but that they put all their eggs in that basket. Nobody could construct an experiment to prove or disprove this belief because it's a philosophical worldview belief. Understand this. Science is a wonderful gift to mankind, but it is only one way of knowing and discovering truth. It works great to figure out what causes birth defects or diseases, or how to build an airplane or construct a highway, that sort of thing. Not so well to tell us why the Mona Lisa is beautiful, or why Beethoven is great music and Boxcar Willie isn't. You can analyze by science the chemical components that make up the Mona Lisa, but the beauty is not in the components. I'm not a naturalist because naturalism undermines human rationality. Now, it drives naturalists crazy to say that naturalism undermines rationality. They call themselves, wait for it, rationalist. They call themselves free thinkers. They say that they have a scientific worldview. But in naturalism, what really matters is not whether our thoughts are rational. It's not whether our beliefs are true. It's whether our thoughts and beliefs are useful. Let me explain this to you. This is a quotation from J.B.S. Haldane. Now he was not a believer. He was like Carl Sagan in England before Carl Sagan. Okay, he was a popularizer of Darwinian theory. And Haldane says this: if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms within my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. And hence, I have no reason to believe that my brain is composed of atoms. Or the atheist philosopher Patricia Churchland puts it this way. She says, boiled down to essentials, a nervous system enables the organism to succeed in the four F's: feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing. The principal chore, she said, she sensed it herself. The principal chore of nervous systems is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. Improvements in sensory motor control confer an evolutionary advantage. A fancier style of representing is advantageous so long as it is geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. So let me unpack a little bit of what she's saying here. What she's saying is that I can have two beliefs about snakes. This would just be an example. So I can have two beliefs about snakes. One belief would be that every snake in the world is poisonous and dangerous to human beings. The other belief is that most snakes are neither poisonous nor dangerous to human beings. One of those beliefs is true. I hope you know which one it is. It's the latter one. Most snakes are not poisonous. Most snakes are not dangerous to human beings. They may be creepy, but they're not dangerous, okay? However, which belief would serve me better, would protect me better from dying of snake bite? The false belief. And what she's pointing out is that in a Darwinian world, it's the function of our beliefs that matters, not the truthfulness of them. Or the late atheist philosopher Richard Rorty echoes this point, putting it differently. He says the idea that one species of organism is unlike all the others, oriented not just toward its own uncreated prosperity, but toward truth, is as un-Darwinian as the idea that every human being has a built-in moral compass, a conscience that swings free of both social history and individual luck. So let me ask you, did you come here today to find out whether Christianity was true or whether it was simply useful? I'm not a naturalist third, because naturalism undermines human freedom and free will. Naturalism undermines human free will and thus our freedom. Again, from the Center for Naturalism. From a naturalistic perspective, there are no causally privileged agents. Nothing that causes without being caused in turn. Human beings act the way they do because of the various influences that shape them, whether these be biological or social, genetic or environmental. We do not have the capacity to act outside the causal connections that link us in every respect to the rest of the world. This means we do not have what many people think of as free will, being able to cause our behavior without our being fully caused in turn. And when I go on campuses, I will read this quotation, because if I don't read it, they'll just say, well, you're just making that up. No, I'm letting the atheists speak for themselves. I'm letting the atheists tell the glory of God. Or Sam Harris, he just cuts to the chase again. Free will is an illusion. Our wills are simply not of our own making. Thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we are unaware and over which we exert no conscious control. We do not have the freedom we think we have. It's an illusion. Now, one way that naturalists will try to show that we are determined rather than being free is to talk about how we can track our brain states, that in the proper environment with the right technology and the right kinds of neuroscientists, they can tell whether somebody is praying, whether somebody's meditating, whether somebody's having a memory, whether they're angry, whether they're sexually aroused. That sort of thing, whether they're dreaming. All right? And they'll say, see, right there, it's all in the brain. The mind just is the brain. And I certainly want to say that the brain is involved in our thinking and our acting. But that does not show that the brain and the brain alone causes our thoughts or our actions. Think about it with me. Now, you can look in this laptop and you will find the data that corresponds to the PowerPoint that's up on the screen right now. If you knew how. I couldn't do it. I'm a philosopher. I don't trust anything under 300. Okay? But somebody could look in the laptop and find the data that corresponds to the PowerPoint presentation. But you won't find the thoughts that brought it about, because those thoughts are in my mind, not in the instrument that I use to communicate those thoughts. Okay, so naturalism is self-refuting. It undermines human rationality. It undermines human freedom and free will. I'm not a naturalist fourth, because naturalism undermines morality. It undermines morality. I've got a quotation here from another friend of mine, Michael Ruse. Michael was a guest at the Greer Heard Forum. I co-edited a book with Michael Ruse, and this is E.O. Wilson. E.O. Wilson taught at Harvard, a former Southern Baptist. And they say this in a journal article. They say, human beings function better if they are deceived by their genes into thinking that there is a disinterested, objective morality binding upon them, which all should obey. We help others because it is right to help them, and because we know that they are inwardly compelled to reciprocate in equal measure. What Darwinian evolutionary theory shows is that the sense of right and the corresponding sense of wrong feelings that we take to be above individual desire and in some fashion outside biology are in fact brought about by ultimate biological processes. Now, this is an interesting statement coming particularly from Michael Ruse. As I said, we're friends. Seven or eight years ago, one of my bosses said, we're thinking about hiring another philosophy professor. I was excited about that. He said, I'd like you to email all your philosophy friends and ask them if they or one of their students might be interested in coming to work here at NOBTS. And so I did. And Michael's one of my philosopher friends. And pretty soon after I sent the email out, Michael emails me back, and he says, I could never recommend any of my students to an institution that teaches that homosexual relations is a sin. And I thought, I wonder what gene deceived him into thinking that that was actually wrong. See, they don't even live by what they teach. Again, from naturalism.org. From a naturalist perspective, behavior arises out of the interaction between individuals and their environment, not from a freely willing self that produces behavior independently of causal connections. Therefore, get this, individuals don't bear ultimate originative responsibility for their actions in the sense of being their first cause. Given the circumstances, both inside and outside the body, they couldn't have done other than what they did. Nevertheless, we must still hold individuals responsible in the sense of applying rewards and sanctions so that their behavior stays more or less within the range of what we deem acceptable. This is partially how people learn to act ethically. Naturalism doesn't undermine the need or possibility of responsibility and morality, but it places them within the world as understood by science. They said it, not I. But the question after you read that statement is this: just how do you hold someone responsible who isn't responsible and couldn't have done other than what they did? This is simply naturalists not being willing to live up to their worldview. They are stealing from the Christian worldview. This is a case where naturalists want to have their cake and eat it too. Fifth, I'm not a naturalist because naturalism undermines human relationality. Okay? You knew at some point we'd have to talk about love. But understand this, it's not love if it's not free. Love is not simply something that our genes or our hormones or some other physical drive causes us to feel. How many of you have a significant other in this room? Let me see your hands. Good for you. I'm surprised how many people didn't raise their hands, especially people that look like couples. One is raising and... okay. Well, try this. Go home and tell your significant other, baby, my jeans are making you look really good right now. And see how that goes for you. Okay, sixth, I'm not a naturalist because naturalism cannot explain human consciousness. Now, there are lots of things that naturalism can't explain. I'm having to cut this lecture short for time's sake, but let's understand consciousness is a biggie. Now, consciousness is this sense that everybody has that you are you and not me, that you're having your thoughts, you have your feelings, you have your experiences, okay? That you believe one thing and maybe somebody else believes another, but it's your personal belief, all right? And naturalism is wholly unable to explain consciousness. And when they try, they say absurd things. Here's the atheist philosopher of mind, John Searle, and he says this, physical events can have only physical explanations, and consciousness is not physical. So consciousness plays no explanatory role whatsoever. If, for example, you think you ate because you were consciously hungry, or got married because you were consciously in love with your prospective spouse, or spoke up at a meeting because you consciously disagreed with the main speaker, you are mistaken in every case. In each case, the effect was a physical event and therefore must have an entirely physical explanation. That's troubling. That is just absurd. Or let me read to you from Thomas Nagel. Now, Thomas Nagel is one of the world's great living philosophers. He teaches at NYU, New York University. He is an atheist. But I wish I'd said this. He says this, "The existence of consciousness is both one of the most familiar and one of the most astounding things about the world. No conception of the natural order that does not reveal it as something to be expected can aspire even to the outline of completeness. And if physical science, whatever it may have to say about the origin of life, leaves us necessarily in the dark about consciousness, that shows that it cannot provide the basic form of intelligibility for this world. There must be a very different way in which things as they are make sense. And that includes the way the physical world is, since the problem cannot be quarantined in the mind." Now, Nagel is just very honestly seeing the facts for what they are. If you're new to Thomas Nagel, you're saying, you said this guy was an atheist? He's an atheist. Do you know why he's an atheist? Because he wants to be. He has a famous quotation that I don't have in a PowerPoint slide, but I can paraphrase it for you, which says, it troubles me. He says, it's not just that I don't believe in God and want, like everybody else, to believe that they're right. I don't want there to be a God. It troubles me that some of the smartest, most intelligent people I know are Christians. I don't want the universe to be that way. Do you see how this is not being driven by rationality, but by the will? Okay, well, we're back to Patricia Churchland, Pat Churchland, and her husband Paul, and they are top philosophers, and so they're being interviewed by the New Yorker magazine, or a story was written on them in New Yorker magazine, and the author says this: one afternoon recently, Paul says he was home making dinner when Pat burst in the door. Remember Pat, the 4Fs lady? And having come straight from a frustrating faculty meeting, she said, "Paul, don't speak to me. My serotonin levels have hit bottom. My brain is awash in glucocorticoids. My blood vessels are full of adrenaline. And if it weren't for my endogenous opiates, I'd have driven the car into a tree on the way home. My dopamine levels need lifting. Pour me a Chardonnay, and I'll be down in a minute." That is the logical way to talk if you believe that everything in this world is material. So for all of these reasons and more, friends don't let friends become naturalists. Okay, let me give you some practical strategies for talking to atheists. Before I give you a couple of particular strategies, I want to give you some general strategies. And I know I'm going to be close on my time here, but I think I've got about 10 minutes. So hopefully we can do some Q&A. If not, I'm probably not going to stop myself short because I am one of the most interesting people I know. But I will be around to talk and take all your questions. So, general strategies when talking to atheist or naturalist: use their authorities. Did you notice how many non-believers I quoted and how few believers I quoted? After I got to the why I'm not a naturalist, I didn't quote a single theist. Not one. When you use their authorities, they can't say, "Oh, you're just making that up." Plus, I can't say it as spectacularly as they do. I'm a trained philosopher. I can't talk that way. Second, well, let me get back to using their authorities. The worst that can happen is they say, "Well, I don't believe what Richard Dawkins believes." That's good. You need to say, "Great, I don't either. Are there some other areas that you could agree with me in?" The worst that could happen is you just have to say, "Well, take it up with Dawkins or Harris. They're your heroes, not mine." And you divide the camp. Secondly, do not argue evolution with an atheist. Okay? Christian conferences like this are the place where we ought to argue evolution. Okay? But evolution is such a difficult topic. It involves so many sciences, interdisciplinary, interwoven, and so forth. It's just a conversation that you don't need to have. It's like trying to get from Charlotte to Richmond by first going through Australia. You just don't need to have that conversation. Which means don't argue the age of the earth. And use questions. Use questions. Questions make them the expert. And when you don't have an answer to a question, it stays with you. It bothers you. And you want what you say to stay with them. Okay? Okay, let me give you a couple of specific strategies here. Here's one. Ask them how old the universe is. Now, some of you are going, I thought you said we weren't going to argue the age of the universe. We're not. Just ask how old the universe is. Now, they frequently, almost all the time in my experience, will say that the universe is more than 13 billion years old, because that's what the leading cosmology indicates. And they often assume that all Christians believe in a young universe. Well, if they say that, you've got them. Point out to them that if something has an age, any age at all, then it has a birthday. It has a beginning. And point out to them that if something has a beginning, then it has a cause. And they've already agreed that the universe had a beginning when they said it's 13.8 billion years old. Therefore, the universe had a cause. Or stuff pops into and out of existence for no reason at all. And that's not what quantum mechanics says. Now note, this does not prove God's existence. It proves that the universe had a cause. It certainly doesn't prove the existence of the Christian God. But the cause is consistent with the Christian God. Because the universe is composed of matter, energy, space, and time, the cause can't be material. The cause cannot be in time. So it's outside space, outside time. It has to be incredibly powerful because our universe has been expanding for a long time. It has to be incredibly intelligent because, as J. Warner Wallace shared with us this morning, the universe is incredibly fine-tuned. And fine-tuning, design is a mark of intelligence. So it has to be personal because intelligence is had by persons, not by forces. Nobody talks about the intelligence of electromagnetism or gravity. That sort of thing. And who does that sound like? But notice this, the age of the universe is not the issue. The key is getting them to admit that the universe has an age. Second, let me give you a different strategy. Ask them if they believe in investigation and research. Now understand this, they're rationalists, they're free thinkers, they're scientifically minded. Of course they believe in it. Ask them how they have investigated the question of God. And I can tell you, most of them got it from Dr. Google. That sort of thing. Now, ask them how important the existence of God, life after death, heaven and hell eternally, that sort of thing. How important is this issue? It's vitally important. Now think with me. I don't spend as much time shopping for shoes as I do shopping for a car. My wife will say I spend way too little time shopping for shoes. Most of the time, I get my shoes from Amazon. Okay, that sort of thing. Just, you know, shoe purchase is not that big a deal to me. But a car purchase, I'm gonna investigate. I'm going to go to several dealerships. I'm going to test drive. Because that's going to be a bigger purchase. But I don't spend the amount of time purchasing a car, investigating that, as I do buying a house. When you buy or sell a house, you get a professional to help you, don't you? You want a team working with you. That sort of thing. But a house is minimal in importance compared to your eternal soul. The possibility of life after death, that sort of thing. So then ask them if the intensity of their research into the question of does God exist is Christianity true, has been equal to the importance of the question. I'll share a personal testimony. I wrote my dissertation on the intersection of philosophical hermeneutics and historical Jesus research. And I knew that that's a highly interdisciplinary area. I knew that I was going to have to study structuralist thought. And so I went to, took a PhD seminar at the University of Texas in Arlington from a man who was a student of Claude Lévi-Strauss, one of the fathers of structuralism. Then I had a two-semester seminar in the philosophy of deconstruction and the thought of Jacques Derrida from a man who was a devotee of Derrida. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Then I went to Oxford University to study with N.T. Wright, one of the great historical Jesus scholars of our day, and that was just to get ready to write my prospectus. I studied with experts. Invite the atheist to study with experts on God. And they say, well, you know, I don't believe in God. That's okay. If God doesn't exist, he won't do anything to you. It won't change your life. So that's what I've got for you. We've got 30 seconds. So, well, I will tell you this. That's a great question, and the question was, what book would I recommend? Now, this may sound a little odd, because I am not a Darwinian. I've said some pretty negative things about Darwinism in this talk, in fact. But when a person tells me, I don't believe in God because of the science, or I can't believe in God because I'm a scientist, I give them Francis Collins' book, The Language of God. Now, The Language of God, Francis Collins is a theistic evolutionist, or he'd say an evolutionary creationist. In The Language of God, he has the best, short, understandable argument in favor of theistic evolution I've ever seen. But what he has in the book are several strong arguments for the existence of God and the truthfulness of Christianity. And what it does is it says this man accepts Darwin's theory of biological evolution and he has no problem being a Christian. So when someone gives me, so the books I give out depend on the person I'm dealing with. I give that book out as much as any other book that I give out. Mere Christianity would be right up there with it too. Thank you for your time. We have to respect our time. I'll be around if you have other questions. Thank you for coming.